How many people went to the state agency and said they were being discriminated against in these categories, leading to investigations, and how many of those investigations were then dropped?
The Dunleavy administration quietly rolls back discrimination protections for LGBTQ Alaskans. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, March 6th. Good evening, I'm Wesley Early. Also tonight, residents of the Prince of Wales Island community of Craig contend with water treatment failures.
We're not getting any answers from the city people. And I think it's a full-on crisis, to tell you the truth.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The future looks bright because the University of Alaska is on a mission to empower Alaska. From drone piloting to vital climate research to critical mining solutions, the University of Alaska's three universities and their community campuses shape the jobs and careers that fuel the economy, creating a more empowered Alaska for all. Learn more at empower.alaska.edu. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
Months ago, Alaska Governor Mike Dunleavy's administration quietly modified a policy from the State Human Rights Commission removing protections for LGBTQ Alaskans from most forms of discrimination. The commission is now refusing to investigate related complaints. That's the finding from a new report from the Anchorage Daily News and ProPublica. Reporter Kyle Hopkins wrote the story and he joins us now. Hi, Kyle.
Hey, Wes.
So explain what happened here. How did the state end up adding protections for LGBTQ people and then reversing itself?
This was all enacted by the Alaska State Commission for Human Rights, which is like the civil rights agency within state government that investigates complaints of discrimination, workplace discrimination, but also just basic discrimination based on race, sex, age, all the factors that one might be discriminated against. They hear those complaints. People come to them and say, make allegations, and they investigate. And so this agency had made a policy change, a significant one, but one that didn't get a ton of attention at the time, after a U.S. Supreme Court ruling in 2020 that said the agency in 2021 said, we're now going to investigate, based on the Supreme Court ruling, we're now going to investigate complaints of discrimination against people based on sexual orientation and gender identity in all categories. And that was a big deal at the time. And what we reported on was that was in place for about a year or so, and then it kind of quietly was rolled back in the fall.
Yeah, you mentioned that it basically disappeared from the website kind of overnight. It wasn't broadly sent out in press releases. Can you talk about the timeline for when that language was removed and how you were made aware of the change?
Sure. Well, for me, this story came out of reporting. It kind of grew out of reporting on some of the issues at City Hall, at Anchorage City Hall. You know, there had been I'd been working on a timeline about one of the allegations against the Bronson administration, which was that there was a, because the city has its own civil rights arm and agency that investigates complaints. And so I had been working on a timeline that included the firing of the head of that city agency. And she had sued the state. There's an ongoing lawsuit where she says that she was fired because she had started investigating a library official for making discriminatory remarks, and some of those remarks involved, LGBTQ issues. And so I was interested in the idea of, well, if you were to feel like you were a victim of discrimination and you wanted to report it to someone, who would you report it to? And that led to looking at the State Commission a little bit and, and just becoming aware that they had at one point been investigating those cases and then had stopped. And then the key moment was, I was familiar with the state agency's website, and it just explicitly says on that website, and has for years, it just says, hey, it's illegal to discriminate based on these factors. And so I looked at the Wayback Machine or the Internet Archive, and I just kind of went back month after month. And sure enough, there was a point where it popped up on that website that they were saying, no ifs, ands, or buts, that it was illegal to discriminate based, against someone who's gay or trans. And then that disappeared. And so that kind of led to the reporting that led to the story.
And, you know, there seems to be conflicting legal advice given to the commission during this time period about how to investigate LGBTQ complaints. You interviewed the director of the commission for this story. What did he say about that?
Well, he said that they, after the Supreme Court ruling, which is called Bostock versus Clayton, and it held that I'm going to get out over my skis a little bit, but my understanding is it held that discrimination against someone based on sexual orientation or gender identity is inherently based on their sex. And therefore, if it's illegal to discriminate against someone based on sex, it's also illegal to discriminate against someone based on their gender identity, for example. And so they started making a policy change after that Supreme Court ruling. And then, according to the commission director, they got legal advice from the Department of Law. So the Attorney General's own Department of Law gave them legal advice that then gave them the confidence to say, yeah, we are doing this. We are, this is our new policy, right? And so, but then in August of last year, the Attorney General himself weighs in and says, no, that's not how we're going to do things. And then that's when the protections were dialed back.
Sure. What have you heard from advocates of the LGBTQ community about how the elimination of these protections and lack of investigation could impact Alaskans?
Well, the story included a statement from Identity Alaska, which is, a nonprofit advocacy group. And they actually had published this essay by the Human Rights Commission, by the state agency, that said, you know, here's the new paradigm. Here's the new, you know, manner in which we're going to investigate these complaints. And it's going to include all categories. So they had published that. And then in our story, we included a response from them saying that they called it unconstitutional and they called it state-sponsored discrimination. I think the big question that our story doesn't answer and I think is unknown is how many cases, if any, were heard? You know, how many people went to the state agency and said they were being discriminated against in these categories leading to investigations? And how many of those investigations were then dropped when this policy was changed? We have no idea what that might be.
Well, Kyle Hopkins is a reporter with the Anchorage Daily News and ProPublica. Thank you so much for joining us today, Kyle.
Anytime. Good to see you.
A former Sitka doctor accused of multiple counts of sexual assault 4 years ago is now behind bars. On the first day of what was expected to be a lengthy trial, 79-year-old Richard McGrath made a surprise plea deal and will spend the next 2 years in prison. KCAW's Robert Woolsey has more, and just a note, graphic details in this story may be inappropriate for some listeners.
Dr. Richard McGrath has nearly come to trial twice. His first court date in 2020 was postponed because of the COVID pandemic. His second, last July, was declared a mistrial when the court failed to impanel a full jury. But McGrath's four-year journey to justice ended the morning of Monday, March 6, just a few minutes before jury selection was to begin for a third attempt at a trial. Judge Michael McConaughey put the question to McGrath.
So to the charge of sexual assault in the third degree, as I read to you, what is your plea?
I'm guilty, Your Honor.
Two of McGrath's three victims were in the courtroom for the hearing, and they visibly reacted to his admission of guilt. Over the weekend, two of them had consented to a hastily crafted deal that, if the judge agreed, would see McGrath sentenced to 17 years in prison, with 15 suspended, and permanently lose his medical license. A third victim did not think that was sufficient. A relative, Jessica Hames, spoke on the victim's behalf.
Mr. McGrath was hired into a position of trust and power as a doctor by the city of Sitka. He abused that power and violated the sacred trust between doctor and patient. I do not care how old and feeble Dr. McGrath is or pretending to be at this moment. He is a dangerous, sick predator who caused irreparable damage to these women. I would like to ask every man in this courtroom, including you, Your Honor, how you would like this to be handled if it were you who had been violated.
Bailey Wolfstead with the state's Office of Special Prosecutions explained some of her rationale for the deal. She had received medical records which indicated that the 79-year-old defendant was in a state of mental decline that would create issues of competency in the event his case went to appeal. She said that the protracted delay had been exceptionally hard on the victims, And while there was never any certainty of winning a conviction in front of a jury, she had little doubt that she could prove some of the charges.
I'm imagining we're having at least one woman on a jury, and it, based on those experiences and how doctors regularly perform your exams, and that if they're, for example, going to perform a breast exam, they're going to tell you they're doing it, and it's certainly not going to involve things like squeezing someone's nipple or taking your breast out of your bra and shirt without telling you what's going on and what's happening.
Regardless of the outcome of a possible jury trial on criminal charges, McGrath still faces a civil lawsuit brought by the victims in a trial scheduled for this July. Wolfsted said that the plea deal would bring finality to this aspect of a complicated case and perhaps most importantly put McGrath behind bars.
Dr. McGrath's going to jail this morning. As the court knows, there's a statutory requirement. He pleads guilty to a sex crime. He is going to jail today.
McGrath attorney John Cashin did not offer any counterargument in the proceedings, telling Judge McConaughey that he intended to argue mitigating factors at his client's sentencing hearing on June 12th. In the meantime, I'll certainly be asking the court to honor the plea agreement, he said. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Iditarod mushes are finally out on the trail.
Now we actually get to run dogs a little bit, and it makes it feel a little bit more real, not like we're just kind of in limbo.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Grant applications are now being accepted for tribal justice grants through the U.S. Department of Justice. Coordinated Tribal Assistance Solicitation, or CETAS grants, fund tribal courts and tribal law enforcement, open to federally recognized tribes across Alaska. Applications are open until March 21st. Learn more at atjrc.org/CTAS. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tribal Justice Resource Center.
After two roof collapses in 2 days at Anchorage businesses, firefighters urge people to clear excess snow off their roofs and be alert for signs of a possible collapse. Anchorage Fire Department Assistant Chief Alex Boyd says there have been four roof collapses in the city so far this year, following a trio of massive Anchorage snowstorms in December. That's more collapses than normal.
It's a high year for sure.
Fire crews say nobody was hurt in either of the weekend collapses. Firefighters also responded about 2 weeks ago to a carport collapse without injuries. But last month, a roof collapse at a CrossFit exercise studio killed a woman. Boyd says people should be on alert for signs of a possible roof collapse, including sagging, nails loosening from walls, and new cracks in finished surfaces. He says the most important tip is to listen for sounds of strain.
Wood will complain before it fails. It makes creaking noises and popping noises before the wood actually fails. And oftentimes that's the first indication that it may collapse, and that's when we start getting calls in some of these buildings that something cracked or popped.
An emerging concern from firefighters as spring nears is freeze-thaw cycles. Boyd says heat from within a building can melt snow on roofs. That melt can then flow to gutters and freeze again, trapping water on the roof and possibly concentrating weight beyond what a building can sustain. Most school bus service in the Matanuska-Susitna Borough School District resumed today, a day after drivers ratified a new contract and ended a month-long strike. Members of the drivers' union went on strike at the end of January after rejecting an offer from district contractor Durham School Services. They protested what they called unsafe conditions at the company. Throughout the strike, thousands of Matsu families have had to transport their children to and from school in a district about the size of West Virginia. Patrick Fitzgerald, the union's political coordinator, says contract talks with Durham finally reached a breakthrough on Thursday.
Our negotiating team said, you know, we're in a place where we can't accept your last best final offer. And it's not our negotiating team that's stopping it. It's our membership. They will not vote for it. So we just started saying we need to find somewhere, some common ground here, and just started throwing numbers at each other.
The union officials took the tentative agreement to members Sunday. Fitzgerald says they voted, quote, overwhelmingly to approve it after a four-hour discussion. Fitzgerald says the contract's terms include a $2 an hour raise during its first year, plus 3% raises in its second and third years. The contract also includes raises for bus attendants and monitors, as well as an improved health care plan.
the driver's starter pay is $23.31 the first year, and it'll increase 3% next year, 3% the year after that, which will put them, back to competitive wages with the state.
On Friday, District Superintendent Randy Traney thanked parents and students for their patience during the strike. According to the district's website, some regular Palmer and Butte routes were under rolling cancellations today. Meanwhile, failures at the water treatment plant in Prince of Wales Island's largest community have left some residents with dirty and discolored water and others with none at all. Officials in Craig issued a boil water notice last night and are asking residents to conserve water, quote, as much as possible. Craig City Administrator says crews are working to fix the problem, but as KRBD's Reagan Miller reports, it's unclear when the water will be safe to drink again.
Late Sunday afternoon, Craig residents started to notice problems with their tap water. Jacqueline Vaughn got home around 4:30 and did a double take when she opened her tap.
And wow, it was coming out the color of dark bright yellow. So I actually couldn't believe it.
June Durgan's water is a dark brown, and she says she's afraid to even boil it.
I've lived here my whole life and just turned 66 today and have never seen anything like this.
Brian Templin is Craig City Administrator. He says the pressure started to drop Sunday night.
We had lost water pressure in most areas of town. Some areas don't have any water, and other areas just have reduced pressure. Some areas have muddy or dirty water that somehow mud has gotten into the system because of low water levels in the system.
Craig Public Works crews were able to get one of the plant's four treatment systems running at full capacity that night. By Monday morning, two others were working at partial capacity, and a fourth is expected to come back online late Monday or early Tuesday. But the plant won't be working normally until two of those systems get new filters, and Templin doesn't know when that will happen. Templin says there have been minor issues with the water treatment system over the past few weeks. He says crews had been working toward addressing the issues when the outage happened.
The short of it is that the filter media in our treatment trains has been in need of replacement. But in order to do that, of course, we have to shut down water treatment. And so the Public Works Department has been working on getting ready to do that. But those clogged media, the clogged filter media in the treatment trains has reduced the capacity of treating water.
Templin said around midday Monday that because of low pressure throughout the system, some areas are worse off than others.
Points in the system that are farther out have less water, and the points in the system that are higher in elevation have less water. But beyond that, it's kind of spread all over Craig.
Templin says crews will be looking for leaks in the system once water is working again. But some residents say they feel like the city has left them in the dark. Vaughn, the resident with the yellow water, says the city owed it to residents to warn them, especially since there had been issues at the plant in the previous weeks.
We're not getting any answers from the city people. And I think it's a full-on crisis, to tell you the truth.
Durgan, whose bathtub is full of murky brown water, expressed a similar feeling.
And I think they kind of knew they weren't going to be able to fix it from the get-go, but yeah, anyway, I'm not really a happy camper with our city right now.
Templin says crews are working nonstop to get the systems working again, and that before the outage, there wasn't information to give out.
We were dealing with some issues with the system, but we weren't at a point that there was any information really to give out to the public. The failure yesterday came as a surprise.
Templin says that residents should report any leaks they see around town, including in their own homes. Until the boil water notice is lifted, residents are advised to boil all water used for drinking, cooking, or teeth brushing for at least 2 minutes. The notice will remain in effect until the State Department of Environmental Conservation determines that the water is safe to drink. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm Reagan Miller.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Matson, delivering the goods and materials Alaskans depend on. On Facebook at Matson in Alaska. Matson, supporting public media in Alaska.
Parents go to great lengths to protect their little ones. When it comes to protection from childhood diseases, go with the safest, most effective choice. Start strong by getting all recommended vaccines for your baby by age 2. Learn more at vaccinate.alaska.gov. That's vaccinate.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health.
Parts of the Kenai River are still frozen over, but the Alaska Department of Fish and Game has already closed the early and late king salmon runs to sport fishing, also shutting down the beleaguered Cook Inlet East Side set net fishery before fishermen can gear up. Ken Coleman is vice president of the Kenai Peninsula Fishermen's Association, which represents set netters. He says he's never seen the fishery close completely this early.
This is my 53rd year coming up as a set netter, and I have never experienced this.
Fish and Game releases a preseason forecast for the early run every winter to give guides and fishermen a sense of what to expect before the summer starts. This year, the department projects fewer than 3,000 kings in the early run and about 13,500 in the late run, falling below the goal range set by the Board of Fish of 15,000 to 30,000 fish. In a pair of emergency orders released last week, the department said that meant it would close all sport fishing for king salmon in the river. Changes have been hard on guides who long relied on taking clients on king salmon trips. As counts have continued to decline and closures have become more common, they've pivoted to fishing for sockeye, halibut, and trout. But for set netters, whose fishery also closes when the king sport fishery does, there's no plan B. Coleman said Friday his phone had been ringing all day since the orders came out.
But they've been asking, is there any way to make a change? Is there anything mechanical that we can do? Set netters such as fishing less or fishing shallower nets.
Legal action and out-of-cycle proposals to the Board of Fish both failed last year. Coleman says the best they can hope for is in the middle of the summer, the department makes another assessment and gets to a point where it's able to reconsider opening the fishery, at least partially. But he says that would require a miracle. Meanwhile, Denali National Park is proposing to build 17 miles of new trails east of the park's highway. The National Park Service is taking public comment on the long-envisioned project and anticipates starting work on it as early as this summer. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The new trails are slated for Denali National Park lands between the park's highway and the Nenana River. An NPS release says the purpose is to provide recreational opportunities in an area that does not depend on park road access and does not impact wilderness.
It's a very appropriate place in Denali National Park for the development of trails. It's a non-wilderness area. It's front country. It's easily accessible. It's close to our visitor facilities.
Park Outdoor Recreation Planner Jennifer Johnston describes what's proposed for the area.
There would be about 8 miles of a multi-use trail that would be open to hikers and bicyclists, more close to the highway. And then more closely paralleling the Nenana River would be trails that would be open to hikers only. And then at the very southern portion of the project area, there would be a 2-mile loop that would be fully accessible, so accessible to wheelchairs and any other folks that have mobility needs.
The new trails would be accessible from the north end of the project at the Riley Creek Day Use area and on the south end at an existing Parks Highway trailhead and parking lot. An environmental assessment for the trails project has been completed, and the Park Service is seeking additional public feedback through March 30th. An in-person meeting is happening Thursday, March 9th at the park's Murray Science and Learning Center with a virtual session on Friday the 10th. Barring any new issues being raised, Johnston says the agency hopes to get started on trail construction this summer. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
The Iditarod Trail Sled Dog Race got underway this weekend with a ceremonial start in Anchorage Saturday and the official race start in Willow on Sunday. Currently, Nick Petit leads the pack as the first musher into the Roan checkpoint. Just 33 teams took off, the lowest number in the race's 50-year history. But as Alaska Public Media's Lex Trinan reports, there was still lots of excitement on the trail.
Temperatures dropped below 0 degrees in downtown Anchorage as mushers prepared for the ceremonial start. It was especially cold if you came from Australia 5 weeks ago, like musher Christian Turner did. He was wearing a heavy-duty jacket down to his ankles.
Yeah, so this is a non-stop dogwear muumuu, and it's basically an Arctic anorak. You can put anything, all your normal clothes underneath it, and then the anorak goes over top and keeps everything warm and everything compressed. It's sort of like wearing a sleeping bag.
Despite the cold temps, Turner and plenty of other mushers were excited for the untimed 11-mile parade along city streets and trails. Around the corner from Turner, Riley Dyke sipped coffee.
Yeah, well, you have like a week of hurry up and wait and hurry up and wait. And now we actually get to run dogs a little bit, and it makes it feel a little bit more real, not like we're just kind of in limbo. So
the staging area along 4th Avenue was quieter than usual for an Iditarod ceremonial start. with about half the number of teams as average. The sounds of yipping dogs was more subdued. Still, the event drew thousands of people out along the trail to watch. Rookie Bridget Watkins says she's glad extroverted mushers like herself can feed off the crowd's energy one last time before embarking on the real race.
Just like I feed off the fans' enthusiasm, the dogs feed off my enthusiasm, so it's just like this big giant ball of excitement everywhere, and that's what the start's about.
Out on course, mushers kept the enthusiasm high, stopping to chat with fans or even eat hot dogs. Jason Mackey had another way of interacting with the crowd. Before starting, he reaches into his sled bag to show off his goodie bags.
I don't know, there's probably 20 pounds of filled booties with candy, so.
He tosses those signed neon booties to kids along the trail. Fans also pass out drinks to mushers who sometimes aren't ready for a cocktail at 10 in the morning. Veteran Aaron Peck says he makes some exceptions, though.
I only accept IPA, good quality beer. Don't hand me that light beer stuff, you know, and hot dogs. I'm hungry, so if anyone's got a hot dog, you know, that's good. But
once the fanfare's all over, though, mushers turn to what they really came for, the official start in Willow. Temperatures had climbed to double digits by the time the 33 teams took off at 2 p.m. on Sunday.
3, 2, 1.
There he goes. The first musher on Iditarod, 51, Jesse Holmes.
Rookie Jed Stevenson says the Iditarod is a culmination of a lifetime dream. The Idaho musher says he's only trying to have little thoughts as he prepares to hit the trail for the first time.
Little thoughts is just getting down the trail and stopping in about 50 miles and leaving it at that and not thinking about 1,000, because that would crush my soul if I thought about that too long.
For some dogs, too, there was some nervous anticipation. Marty, one of reigning champion Brent Sass's dogs, was barking excitedly before the start. The young dog had some big shoes to fill as the son of one of Sass's main leaders last year, who retired this year.
Young, energetic, and has no idea what he's getting himself into right now. So, but he's ready to go. It's pretty fun. He's the youngest guy in the team.
For Sass, going into his 8th Iditarod, the pressure of getting his second win wasn't high on his mind.
I feel like I'm the calmest I've ever been for any Iditarod start.
He says after all the fanfare, he's ready for his Iditarod vacation. Reporting in Anchorage and with help from Liz Ruskin in Willow, I'm Lex Trinan.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org and wherever you get your podcasts. We had reports tonight from Robert Woolsey in Sitka, Chris Clint and Lex Trinan in Anchorage, Sabine Pooks in Kenai, Reagan Miller in Ketchikan, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer tonight is Tobin Shelby. Annie Fite and Tim Rocky produced tonight's show. I'm Wesley Early. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips Alaska, building the next generation of Alaska's workforce through investments in education and vocational training to provide jobs right here at home. ConocoPhillips Alaska.
Planning today for a gift down the road builds a legacy of support for the media you treasure. Thank you for considering this public radio station in your estate planning. You can talk to your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. Thank you. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.